This is the 30th broadcast in the America Looks Abroad series, presented by the officers and staff members of the Foreign Policy Association. This nonpartisan organization, open to all who are interested in American foreign policy, offers accurate information on current international events. In the world of today, foreign affairs are your affairs. This week, the world has been hourly awaiting news of Italy's decision about the war. Mrs. Vera Michaelis Dean, Director of the Research Department of the Foreign Policy Association, will discuss Italy Girds Itself for War. Mrs. Dean.
Good afternoon. As the Battle of France rages on the Western Front, with the Germans throwing in fresh men and fresh mechanized forces, world attention is focused on the role Italy may play in the conflict. From the moment Germany invaded Belgium and Holland, the fascist press began to prepare the Italian people for entrance into the war on the side of Germany. Practically every day, some new measure of war preparation has been announced in Rome. Sailings of Italian ships have been suspended. Ships on the high seas have been ordered to put into neutral ports. Cities close to the Franco-Italian border have been evacuated. Troops have been mobilized. Art treasures have been removed from museums. Yesterday, it was reported that Italy would enter the war next Thursday or Friday. A leading fascist weekly declared, "The Italian people are on the eve of a war of supreme independence." To understand the reasons for Italy's slow-motion approach to war, we must look back at its recent history. Italy, like Germany, was late in achieving national unity. For centuries, it was a collection of small and often warring states. Metternich once said disdainfully that Italy was not a country, but a geographical expression. It was only in 1861 that these many small states were united into a single national state under the leadership of Piedmont, ruled by the House of Savoy, one of whose descendants is now King of Italy. But the Italians had lived for so long under the arbitrary rule of many different princes that they had practically no experience in self-government. They were more concerned with the local politics of the small communities in which they lived than with the problems of the new national state. As so often happens in such cases, some of the leaders of the new state developed a spirit of fierce nationalism and began to dream of recapturing the glory of the Roman Empire. They bemoaned the fact that the Mediterranean, which the Romans called our sea, Mare Nostrum, should have become subject to the domination not only of France, which is itself a Mediterranean power, but also of Britain. What they resented most was that the British had acquired control of the exits and entrances of the Mediterranean at Gibraltar and Suez. The British, they pointed out, could bottle up Italy in the Mediterranean and cut off its communications with overseas countries. This would be very dangerous for Italy. Italy lacks most of the raw materials necessary for modern industry, and nearly 80% of its imports come from overseas. If these supplies were suddenly cut off in time of war, Italy might soon find itself unable to keep up industrial production. The Italian nationalists also felt that Italy should have territories outside Europe for its surplus population, which could find no work in the mother country. Before 1914, thousands of Italians had emigrated, many of them to France, but many more to the countries of the New World, the United States, Argentina, Brazil, which could use manual labor. But at the end of the World War, most of the countries which had previously welcomed emigrants from Europe began to impose drastic restrictions on immigration. The United States, too, adopted this policy. So the young Italians who might otherwise have found an outlet for their energies in emigration were forced to remain at home. Like our young people, they began to put pressure on the government to find them jobs and some means of earning a living. But unlike many of our young people who hoped to keep the United States out of war, some of these young Italians are among those particularly anxious to have Italy enter the conflict. Long before Mussolini, Italian nationalists had claimed that emigration was in any case an economic loss to Italy, which would have preferred to use the labor and skill of its citizens in the development of territories under its own political control. The Italian nationalists tried to find such territories in Africa, but France, Britain, Belgium, and Portugal had already brought the best regions of Africa under their rule, and there was not much left for Italy to conquer. The Italians were particularly disappointed when the French, in 1881, established a protectorate over Tunisia, where many Italians from Sicily had settled over a period of years and which Italy hoped eventually to obtain. Friction regarding the position of Italians in Tunisia has been one of Italy's outstanding grievances against France. The Italians had also tried to acquire Ethiopia in 1896, but met with a disastrous defeat. They did conquer a strip of land on the east coast of Africa, but the colonies they established there did not add much to Italy's economic resources. The Italians also fought a war with Turkey in 1911 and 12, as a result of which they occupied Libya and Tripoli in North Africa. But a good part of Libya and Tripoli consists of desert, which is not adapted for colonization. The Italian government had hoped to improve the country's position by fighting in a world war on the side of their allies against Germany and Austria-Hungary. Italy had not been prepared for this war and suffered great losses in men and economic resources. At the Paris Peace Conference in 1919, it obtained practically all the territory it had demanded in Europe, but gained little in Africa and received no share of Turkey's former possessions in the Near East, at a time when Britain was awarded a mandate over Palestine and France a mandate over Syria. Italy therefore felt that its sacrifices during the war had been in vain and that it had been double-crossed by their allies. This feeling of dissatisfaction and disillusion created an atmosphere of unrest in Italy, similar to that which existed in post-war Germany, although technically Italy was in the ranks of the victors, not of the vanquished. This unrest, in turn, facilitated the rise to power of Italian fascists, headed by Mussolini, who in 1922 was summoned by the king to become premier. Mussolini had been a socialist, and he might have been expected to oppose imperialism, but instead he took over many of the ideas of the Italian nationalists, and like them, dreamt of restoring the Roman Empire. Unlike the early nationalists, he realized that Italy would be unable to play an important role in world affairs until it had become strong and united at home and was in a position to bargain on equal terms with the great powers. What irked him most, as it irked many other Italians, was the attitude of France and Britain, who during and after the World War ridiculed Italy's military strength, pointed out its economic weaknesses, and treated Italy as a third-rate country. We must not underestimate the effect of such feelings on international relations. The British were not even conscious that they were offending the Italians when they praised Italy for its gondoliers and archaeological remains, but pooh-poohed its capacities as a colonial power. It was that very unconsciousness and complacency on the part of the British which so profoundly irritated the Italians. This feeling of irritation reached an acute stage in 1935, when Mussolini invaded Ethiopia, determined to succeed where Italy had failed. As you remember, Britain at that time took the lead in persuading the League of Nations to impose economic sanctions on Italy. I have already pointed out that fear of being cut off from access to raw materials had haunted Italian nationalists ever since the formation of the Italian national state. Economic sanctions thus provided Mussolini with a cause around which he could rally the Italian people, who had not been particularly enthusiastic until then about the invasion of Ethiopia. At the same time, economic sanctions did not affect vital raw materials like oil, with the result that they did not prevent Italy from conquering Ethiopia. And the very fact that France and Britain failed to prevent this conquest convinced Mussolini that the Western democracies had become impotent and would no longer constitute a real threat to Italian aspirations in the Mediterranean. It was Britain, not France, who was most anxious in 1935 to prevent the conquest of Ethiopia. Up to then, France had advocated the use of League sanctions, but always in the expectation that they would be applied against Germany. France had no desire to use sanctions against Italy. The French had been far more realistic about European affairs than the British. They hoped to use Italy as a counterweight against Germany in the Balkans, and especially hoped that Italy would help them to prevent the union of Austria and Germany. Monsieur Laval, who was then French premier, went to Rome in January 1935. Although we have no documentary proof of this, it is believed that he then gave Mussolini a free hand in Ethiopia, in return for a promise by Il Duce to collaborate with France regarding Austria. Many people at that time criticized Monsieur Laval and called him a horse trader. But in the perspective of the past 5 years, it would seem that he may have been right in trying to keep Italy in the camp of France and Britain. You may have noticed that last week Monsieur Laval was received by the President of France, and it was reported that he had gone to Rome for a last-minute attempt at Franco-Italian reconciliation. Premier Reynaud has made a public bid for settlement of Franco-Italian disputes and has dropped his foreign minister, Monsieur Daladier, who had once said France would not yield one inch of territory to Italy. But much water has flowed under the bridge since 1935. Italy, embittered by League sanctions, turned to the only great power in Europe which had remained its friend, and that was Nazi Germany. This friendship was first tested by Italo-German intervention in Spain. It was cemented in May 1939 by an alliance known as the Pact of Steel. But Count Ciano, Italy's foreign minister and Mussolini's son-in-law, warned the Nazis at that time that Italy needed 3 years to complete its war preparations and that it would not participate in a war against Poland, where it claimed no interest. It was probably with these considerations in mind that Mussolini, at the outbreak of war last September, proclaimed Italy a non-belligerent. In the role of non-belligerency, Italy has been of real aid to Germany. It has immobilized Allied forces on the Franco-Italian frontier, in the Eastern Mediterranean, and in Africa. It has served as a channel for supplies to Germany from overseas countries, including the United States. Yet even so, it would be more desirable from the point of view of the Allies if Italy could remain a non-belligerent for the duration of the conflict. For Italy, with an air force of between 4,000 and 6,000 planes and a large fleet of submarines, could cause considerable damage to their allies in the Mediterranean. But Mussolini, too, has some troublesome questions to solve before he casts the die for war. Italy has accumulated reserves of certain key raw materials, like oil, cotton, rubber, and scrap iron, and Germany has promised to keep it supplied with coal. But these supplies are adequate only if the war is very short. Mussolini would therefore prefer to wait until the last minute before entering the conflict. The Germans themselves pointed out last week that Italy would not enter the war until it was sure France was no longer capable of retaliating and would wait either for the siege of Paris or for the destruction of the French Air Force. If Italy can cause damage to their allies, it is also vulnerable to Allied attack on its industrial centers in North Italy and on its colonies in East Africa. And while Mussolini might be ready to risk a short war in Europe, he would certainly not want to engage Italy in a prolonged conflict of world dimensions, such as might develop if Italy's entrance into the war serves as a signal for increased American assistance to their allies. A real conflict, moreover, appears to be still going on beneath the surface in Italy. The Italian people are not militaristic by temper. They love peace. They hope to avoid war. They are at one and the same time anti-German and anti-British, but they are not anti-French, and would find it distasteful to attack France. The king, who enjoys great popular respect, the Vatican, which has wide influence in predominantly Catholic Italy, and even some of the more moderate fascists, are apparently urging Mussolini to preserve the status of non-belligerency. But Mussolini is subjected to pressure from two quarters, from the militant elements of the fascist party, and from Hitler, who is more likely to call for Italian aid if Germany runs into a stalemate on the Western Front than if it is on the point of winning an outright victory. Mussolini is a proud man. He would resent being put in the position of having to obey Hitler's bidding. Yet the decision may no longer be in his hands, and Mussolini may discover, if he enters the war, that he is merely exchanging Franco-British domination of the Mediterranean for German domination of the European continent.
Mrs. Vera Michelis Dean, Director of the Research Department of the Foreign Policy Association, was today's speaker in the America Looks Abroad series. Her topic was Italy Girds Itself for War. If you would like a free copy of this talk, send your request to the Foreign Policy Association, 8 West 40th Street, New York. We invite you to tune in next Sunday on most of these same stations to hear another speaker in the America Looks Abroad series. This is the National Broadcasting Company, RCA Building, Radio City, New York.